welcome to the Ivy Hoops podcast. It's a podcast about Ivy Hoops. First episode of the season, Ivy Hoops Online 6th of us having a podcast here. A lot to break down on our season debut episode where all 8 Ivies stand on both the men's and women's sides. And we're also going to run through our women's and men's players of the decade that just ended, which really was a transformative decade for Ivy League basketball as we know it, and we'll talk about why. Definitely some divergence of opinion among our writers on who the best players were in the decade that was. But first, I want to introduce the IHO writers, Mike Tony, editor of Ivy Hoops Online here, joined by, first off, IHO writer extraordinaire, Rob Brown. Happy new decade, Rob.
Happy new decade to you, Michael, and the same to you, George.
Yes, joining me is the brilliant IHO scribe, George Clark. Happy new decade to you as well, George.
Happy new year to both of you. It's great to be back with you both, and it's great to be on the eve of what promises to be a real shootout in the Ivy League.
It certainly does. It certainly does. I wanted to start off with, I asked IHO's contributors to submit their Ivy Power rankings for both the men and women, and we're going to go through them team by team now, since there seems to be some parity at the top, starting with the men. Harvard was picked to finish atop the league, of course, in the preseason media poll. It would be their 8th Ivy League title in the last 10 years. A pretty remarkable run. But our writers nearly unanimously put Yale at the top of our Ivy Power rankings. Yale, with a pretty impressive resume so far. 10-4 record that includes wins over Vermont, Clemson. Their 4 losses have only come by a combined 17 points to teams in KenPom's top 101 squads. San Francisco is 101st, so I couldn't say top 100. But Yale has the top defense in the Ivy League. Paul Atkinson and Azar Swain rank in the league's top 5 in scoring. Jordan Bruner is stuffing stat sheets every night. Let's start with you, Rob. Why is Yale the strongest looking team in the league right now? What do you think is separating it from Penn and Harvard at this point?
Well, I mean, for me, it's the same thing year after year with Yale. Even though the players changed and they were replaced 4 different players in the starting lineup, Coach Jones has a system. People know their roles, and they also have incredibly talented players. It may not be the deepest team, but their defensive abilities are exceptional, and they've gotten great offensive production. They take high percentage shots. This year, they've also had a lot of benefit from 3-point with Azar Swain. Matt Cotton coming off the bench has been a real big plus for them. And I think the thing with Yale is they've had a consistent effort with a consistent lineup game after game. That's what separates Yale from Harvard for me. Harvard injuries. Obviously, Seth Towns not going to be playing this year, entered the transfer portal, but Bryce Aiken's only, I think, played in 7 games. So, that's not unusual for a Tommy Emeker team, is to kind of figure out things in the non-conference schedule, get healthy, and make their run later. So it wouldn't shock me if the spots switch later on, but right now that's why I give Yale the edge. In terms of Penn, I just think Penn's got an outstanding offense, but their defense is a little bit suspect, especially from 3-point land.
Yeah, what stands out to me about Yale is, first of all, they're playing at a much slower pace than last year. Obviously, they're a good shooting team. What I think bodes well for them, though, is the fact that they've got a very strong perimeter defense. They're 3-point percentage allowed defensively is currently 6th best in the country, according to KenPom. That's something that will be tested in Ivy League play, though. We know that really all Ivy League teams in recent years have seen the benefits, analytically, I suppose, of not being shy shooting from three-point land. Certainly Penn it relies on that, has relied on that more than others so far this season. But yeah, I mean, that's something that will be tested, but it'll also come in handy too. Any early thoughts on Yale from you, George?
One of the most impressive games, two of the most impressive games they played were losses at Penn State by 2 points. Penn State has probably the best team it's ever had in State College, and Yale gave them all they could handle. And then to lose very, very nearly down at North Carolina was also very impressive for Jones and his team. Right now, KenPom, who projects, as you both know, the score in every game, projects Yale to go 13-1 in the Ivy League, losing by 1 point in the season finale at Harvard. So that's some clear indication of how valued Yale's work has been to this point.
Yeah, I think it's a little surprising to me that KenPom has Yale really kind of head and shoulders above even Penn and Harvard at this point. Certainly Penn has the, let's move on to Penn, and we can maybe make the case for why Penn and Harvard are strong as well. Well, let's start with Harvard, actually, because in our Ivy power rankings, Harvard and Penn tied for second, which is unusual. So we'll just start alphabetically with Harvard. Seth Towns, of course, out for the year. That mystery ending in an all too predictable way. Obviously, best of luck to him going forward, though, as a transfer. Harvard's best win, again, going by KenPom, was its latest one, an overtime win at San Francisco. Of course, the Crimson played very well against Maryland in November. Bryce Aiken has not played the last three games, has what the Crimson papers reported as an injured foot. Timetable for his return is unknown. But the Crimson have won all three of those games, of course, including the San Francisco matchup. What's your outlook for Harvard, Rob? Obviously, it's got to be it's different whether or not Bryce Aiken is in the fold or not. But how do you size up where the Crimson stand as we head into Ivy play here?
Harvard is. There's a similarity, just like there's a similarity to Yale every year. The strength of the Harvard program, there is a similarity. They are deep. They are talented, both offensively and defensively, but they kind of build as the season goes. Lewis is playing really well down low. Bassey's had a rough year, but I certainly expect him to bounce back in league play. And for Harvard, the key really will be Aiken. They're super talented. Adds a completely different dimension. He's the guy who's going to take those shots late in the game. He's the guy who's going to get those free throws late in the game. Not having them, certainly, if he's not there, Harvard's still going to do well, but if Aiken's there, he's an incredible X factor.
Yeah, I mean, it's when you look at Harvard, you see a team that traditionally has struggled early on in seasons under Tommy Amaker. As you say, that this is a team that we can expect to build as opposed to just come out of the gate strong. But they do a lot of things well. There aren't any glaring weaknesses from the squad. Unlike some previous Harvard teams, they shoot the ball well from the free throw line. What they are doing is they're cutting down more on turnovers this season. So, you know, things remain to be seen. I mean, this is just a snapshot in time, and they do have another non-conference matchup with UC Irvine tomorrow as we take this at home, one that they should probably be able to take care of, but we'll see. But, yeah, any early thoughts on the Crimson, George?
They need Aiken, and so far they've played pretty well without him, but they're a much better team with Aiken. But it's a tribute to the depth, the talent that Amaker brings in every year that they have done fairly well without him. And they don't have Seth Towns. Now, I can't imagine any other team could lose a Seth Towns and still be considered at the very among the elite in this league. Ledlam, this rookie, has a very good shot at being rookie of the year, and I think Kirkwood is the best sophomore in the league. And as Rob noted, Lewis is continuing to play at a high level. If Aiken is back and if he is healthy, Harvard can win every night out, no question about it.
And moving on to Penn has the league's best scoring offense by far, the best assist-to-turnover ratio. They're making 10.6 made threes per game through 11 contests. That's a full two more than any other Ivy. They're really taking care of the ball, which is why I like where Penn is at right now. They're not really beating themselves. Even in their losses, especially the really ugly loss to Rice, that was a bit of a downer after the Alabama opener. Even in that loss, that you know turnovers were really not the culprit there, and that's something that is encouraging this time of year for sure. I do wonder though if Penn. If it lives by, if it thrives by the three, you can certainly die by the three too, and I can see that. But Penn's pretty strong from 2-point percentage as well. You know, AJ Broder is one of the league's most consistent players for sure. Now Jordan Dingle did miss Penn's most recent game at Howard. I think. You know, there's maybe a bit of a question mark there, but you can do a lot if you don't beat yourself, and Penn hasn't really done that so far. Rob, what are your thoughts on where Penn stands? You know, just, I don't know, how many hours are we away? 26 from, yep. from the tilt with Princeton tomorrow evening.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. The offense, I think the adjusted efficiency is probably the lowest since the Fran Dumphy era. Quite exceptional, especially when you consider that they play three freshmen regularly. You've got, you know, Broder. I guess you have like five people that can put up the points any night. You've got Broder, you've got Bentley, Goodman. Now you have Jordan Dingle, who has ice water in his veins. And, you know, now Max Martz, who's shooting three-pointers at about a 57% rate. That's the great thing. You know, these first years are fearless. We'll see what happens when they enter league play tomorrow, but I really love the offense. If I have any concerns, again, as I said, it's the three-point defense. The rebounding is also a little bit reduced from last year. Not a surprise. It's a you know, Steve Donahue has said he went with a more offensive-oriented four-guard lineup, so you're going to have some sacrifices. But I think right now, and their offense should win the majority of these games.
And what to pivot to fold in a little bit of a Penn-Princeton preview here? What concerns you most, George, about from Princeton's perspective, going up against Penn What about Penn? Does anything about Penn scare you? Let me put it that way.
There are many things about Penn that scare me. Broder is, of course, a legitimate player of the year candidate. Our center, Richmond Arirogoza, played very well against everybody last year, but particularly well against Broder. So they might neutralize each other, but Bentley, when he's hitting threes, and that is his specialty, every bit as dangerous as Devin Kennedy was when he was playing well for us. And Dingle, I'm not sure what he'll be like going forward, but I've seen him play a couple of times this year. He's clearly a legitimate Rookie of the Year candidate. I really like that kid. He adds a lot. He's stepped up early in his career. They put three very good seniors on the floor at the same time, and that is a big advantage. Broder, Goodman, and Bentley. And to have senior leadership like that, that means a lot. You don't see that as much anymore throughout college basketball because the really good players rarely stay around that long. You see more of it in the Ivy League. And I just think Penn has a very, very good chance, and certainly to make the tournament and possibly to win the regular season.
Yeah, I certainly don't sleep on Penn, although I don't think anybody is. One team that maybe some folks could be sleeping on is Brown, the next team in our Ivy Power rankings, just ahead of Princeton. Brown slated by our writers to be fourth currently in the power ranking. Brown's coming off a really nice win against Rhode Island yesterday. Zach Hunsiger with a career-high 22 points. Brandon Anderson currently second in the Ivy League in scoring right now, behind only Mike Smith of Columbia. Rob, you've gotten to see the Bears play up close. What stands out to you about Bruno so far?
They've taken a little bit of a step back from last year, which is not surprising since Desmond Cambridge transferred and Obi Okoli graduated. But they're starting to kind of bounce back. They had a rough patch throughout December. I kind of feel like the second half against St. John's, they played a competitive game against Duke, and last night's game at Rhode Island shows that they're kind of rebounding, getting into form. The thing about Brown, you're going to get consistency from Cho and Anderson every night. Those two guys are going to get their points, get their rebounds, get their assists. The question really for Brown is where do they get other points? Last night they got from Zach Hunsiger. What did he end up with? Did he have a 6 of 8 from three? You know, that's a great night. Josh Howard, I think, is another guy that you could look for. They can get production from those two guys. One, definitely two would be great. I think Brown's in a much better shape. The other issue I think with Brown is they've got to put together a 40-minute game. Sometimes they get behind early or they falter late, but the same could be said for a lot of teams in the lower half of the conference. But I think Brown is looking better than some others right now.
Yeah, I mean, they crashed the offensive boards well. They, as you said, they do have a high number of players that I feel can take over games, which is not new. That's kind of been a staple for Brown the last couple of years, certainly last season when Desmond Cambridge was still in the fold, Obi Okoli as well. Certainly Obi Okoli as well. Yeah, I mean, we'll see how it goes. But, obviously Brown has to start every Ivy League slate with a home and home with Yale, which is a pretty good measure to see where Brown stands at this point. Princeton started season 1-7, but has won 3 of its last 4 since then. actually has pretty strong offensive numbers when you take them as a whole, but has struggled defensively, especially on the perimeter. George, what's your take on where the Tigers stand right now, and how much in the way of momentum you think they have coming into their matchup with Penn?
Whatever momentum they have, it has come in the last couple of weeks, that's for sure. That start was simply appalling. I know it was to Henderson and his staff as well as it was to the Princeton fans. One of the problems was, as it always is, injuries. Ryan Schwieger was not on the floor for much of the early going, and without him, they're a much different team. Ethan Rice is a guy whose statistics, he plays better than his statistics might indicate. He rebounds very well. He defends quite well. And he and Schwieger together being at full speed has made a big difference. Of course, Richmond Arirogozo is just continuing his incredible play from last year. He's a fourth in the paint. He's a terrific rebounder. His shooting percentage is off the chart. So the problem that they've had, and it's been a big disappointment to Mitch, is that they just have not been able to stop the three-point shooters. They've given up a very high percentage of three-point shots, and they didn't make a good percentage of three-point shots until recently. They've been very inconsistent and very poor on defense. They've scored a lot of points recently, and to go into the cluster tomorrow night is really gut check time. If they can give Penn a good game, and then of course turn around and play them next Friday night. Hopefully, if they can play well in the cluster, they can, even if they lose, turn it around next week. But it's Princeton is in a real fight to get into that fourth tournament spot. And I think Brown right now I would rank as, I guess, I couldn't really hear Rob's analysis, but Brandon Anderson and that kid, I think his name is Friday, the freshman, they give Brown a real good shot at the fourth spot. I think Princeton and Dartmouth are going to be heard from before this is over in terms of that fourth spot, and I think Columbia and Cornell are clearly trailing the pack.
Yeah, so Princeton last season I don't think was expected to do nearly as well in its back-to-back with Penn as it did, obviously sweeping the series and putting Penn in a big hole that it struggled all season to get out of just to make the Ivy League tournament. What's the key for Princeton, you think, to picking up another win at the Palestra tomorrow night?
Like George says, I think Richmond is phenomenal. One of my favorite players in the league, and I think he can battle A.J. Broder toe-to-toe, one of the few people that can. So the key is he's got to stay on the court. He's got to stay out of foul trouble. Jalen Llewellyn has got to be more efficient in his scoring. He can certainly put up points. He's got to be more efficient. And then they, I think in some ways they probably have to hope that the freshmen at Penn get some jitters, in their first Ivy game and struggle, because I know that certainly happened when these two teams have played over the last couple of years. Princeton's usually prevailed when Penn really, really struggles getting their points, and that may be something to look at tomorrow as well.
For sure, yeah. I mean, it's—I don't know. It's pretty cliche to say, but when you have a rivalry game, I think a lot of stuff does go out the window, and you kind of see the distilled essence of teams. When they're going at each other. So, certainly when you look at the statistics, Princeton's three-point defense, they rank 342nd, to put it another way, 12th worst in the nation in 3-point percentage defensively.
And I think they've actually improved in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. I mean, that doesn't bode well, though, against a Penn squad that, that looks to beat teams from deep. That would seem to be a mismatch, but then again, you know, we'll see. I'm sure Coach Mitch Henderson and his staff is well aware of putting a premium on the importance of putting a premium on perimeter defense in this matchup. Moving on to Dartmouth, the next team in our Ivy Power rankings. Dartmouth stands at 7-8 after losing what at times was a chippy game against Vermont yesterday. The defense does look much improved so far, though. And Aaron Rye has had an impressive non-conference slate after coming on strong in the last two weekends of Ivy play as a sophomore last season. What do you think, Rob, what do you think Dartmouth's outlook is going into the league slate? Their non-conference is done. You know, they've got 16 days between their Vermont loss and their opener at Harvard on the 18th. What can we expect from Dartmouth come Ivy play?
Well, I think with Dartmouth, first of all, losing Brendan Barry was an enormous hit. He was one of the best three-point shooters in the country last year. That was a big part of their offense, and now that's missing, and you can certainly see the three-point rate at Dartmouth is really a two-point shooting team. They you've got Chris Knight, you've got Aaron Rye, both can really do a nice job on the offensive glass. They can get high percentage shots from inside, but I do worry that they're going to struggle from the three. Torres Samuels will have to be more consistent. I think Dartmouth's another one of those teams that is just they have moments where they really look good, but then they'll just have gaps and they just need to where they kind of falter. Last night being an example where they just kind of faded late. If they can put things, I think they're a good team. They're a solid team. I think they're going to be a competitive team each night, but I just don't think they have the same kind of offensive or defensive firepower that the better teams in, especially the top three, but maybe even a team like Brown, if Hunsicker and Howard can kind of get things going, or if Princeton can kind of right the ship with all the talent they have.
Yeah, Dartmouth did get some good shooting, outside shooting, in their overtime win at UMass Lowell back in November. Really, they haven't not a ton of quality wins for Dartmouth. Every win's a quality win, but wins against the top 250.
Mike, I think something that's interesting to watch as the season begins, Brown, Princeton, and Dartmouth all play two games against Yale, Penn, and Harvard to start the year. If Brown or Princeton or Dartmouth, if any of those teams can get a win in their first two games, I think they'll have a big advantage in getting to the fourth spot.
Moving on is Columbia. What can you really say at this point about Columbia? They're 4-11. They could very easily have a winning record if it weren't for brutal last-second loss after brutal last-second loss. Columbia is now, by my count, 7-23 since the start of the 2016-17 season when Jim Engels took over in games decided by 3 points or less or in overtime. And so far this season, I don't think they've won any game that fits that category. 1-2-3-4-5, 0-5 in that category so far this season. Coming off of a overtime loss, floored by a heartbreaking finish at Maine, a game that they led by 13 with 13.5 to play. You know, it's tough. How much, I want to ask you, George, how much do you think, or how little do you think that coaching plays a part in winning close games? I know Harvard is 19-1 in their last 20 games that went to overtime. They've won 19 out of 20 games. How much of this is just luck, do you think? I mean, I think a lot of this just comes down to lack of execution, maybe. Certainly luck plays a huge role in a lot of these buzzer beaters that Columbia has had to endure. I don't think it's really fair to pin a lot of it on the coaches. What do you think? When you have cutting success one way or the other.
Is a fabulous recruiter, but not so much of a game coach. And I think of a statistic like that in overtime games certainly dispels that theory. He's a good coach, he's a great coach, and he's a great recruiter. Jim Ingles seems to me, I can't fault his coaching for what has happened at Columbia. It's a tough place to recruit. He tries to play a style that perhaps his personnel can't execute. We know what he did over at New Jersey. And he's just had a tough time getting the ponies to do what he would like to see them do. But to lose a game in overtime that they just lost, that's devastating. That's a tough thing for kids to overcome, especially in tight games going forward. I just think Columbia's just a lost cause for this season.
Well, I mean, you know, certainly they can write a new chapter. Maybe if they can get some early success against Cornell in the home to home, they can build on that and get some momentum down the stretch. Four of their last six are at home. Certainly the status of Gabe Stefanini looms large, whether or not he'll be able to come back. Mike Smith is, I suppose, pretty quietly, given his team struggles, having a phenomenal year, certainly offensively. He does his efficiency sometimes is a little bit low. I think he's asked to do a lot offensively. Certainly he's a very aggressive player. But he, you know, that aggression does also get him to the line. It opens up players. He is a great ball distributor. Any thoughts, Rob, in general on where Columbia stands at this point with its D1 non-conference slate Riverview Mirror now?
It's just tough. I mean, it seems like we're having the same conversation about them year in and year out. Not a great non-conference record, but it could have easily been a tremendous record with just a small number of baskets made. And they've also been real. They had Patrick Tepe, leave the program, an all-Ivy forward. He's going to enter the transfer portal for grad transfer next year. So they were kind of like had a couple of hands tied behind their backs at the beginning of the season. In answer to your question about where, is it luck? Is it coaching? Is it the players? It's a mystery, but you would think that something would change. I was watching the Albany and the Maine games and the latter part of both games, it's just, Mike Smith is gassed, and he's just holding the ball for 20 seconds and then trying to do too much. And he's just doesn't have help. And so I don't know if that's, again, I don't know if that's coaching and you got to find a way to design a play, or if you just don't have the players ultimately. And that may just be it. Columbia may just need luck and health and a lack of transfers before their fortune turns around.
Yeah, and the reputation, I think, certainly on in Ivy League Twitter circles, the Columbia has for losing close games, that precedes Jim Engels. That's not just an Engels era thing. That was certainly true in the Kyle Smith era as well. And of course, Kyle Smith, I think folks would agree, I would hope they would agree, is a terrific coach, very, very analytically savvy, and really, I felt, you know, turned down and turned around the program, fortified it, built upon it, I should say. And even then, Columbia was still seen as, and really they did, lose a lot of close games, you know, come up short down the stretch. It does seem to have, you know, we're at a point in the season now where it's happening over and over again to Columbia, and you can't really ignore it. I'm sure as players, you know, if it's frustrating for us as onlookers, it has to be that much more frustrating for them. But, you know, as I said, they can write a new chapter. It's not hard to see them, you know, doing well against Cornell, maybe stringing together a couple upset wins. Certainly last season they actually won four of their last six in Ivy play last season. So they do have some momentum there. And a couple of those games were very close. Certainly the overtime win at the Palestra stands out, as does the win at Brown. Let's go now to the Ivy cellar, as it were, for now. Cornell unanimously picked to come in, to currently be eighth, I should say, in our Ivy power ranking. Just a tough stretch for Cornell. Won its opener at home against Binghamton. Has not won since. Its D1 non-conference slate is over now. Looked pretty well. Looked pretty good, I should say, at Syracuse. Very nearly picked off NGIT and Bryant. Those were back-to-back one-point losses. Speaking of those, close games, and another close loss to Lafayette, which has feasted on Ivy competition this season. Where do you think, Cornell just, doesn't have the defensive firepower, I guess, Rob, or the outside shooting? I mean, what's your analysis of where Cornell stands at this point?
I mean, I guess you have to expect a downward projection after you lose Matt Morgan, and then the year before you had Stone Gettings that left, and in rebounding you lose Steve Julian. So they've lost a lot of high-profile guys, and they just haven't been able to replace them with similar quality athletes. I think Jimmy Boeheim is playing really nicely this year. Terrence McBride's kind of improving as well. Josh Warren took a little bit of a step back so far, but offense, defense, there's just a lot of struggles. I think they're 339th in three-point offense and 299 in three-point defense. The rebounding is okay on the offensive side. They're 122nd in the country, but they're 313th on the defensive side. You're not going to do well. They're not a deep team. They don't shoot well. They're not defending well. I'm sure Coach Earl is trying to figure out what can he do to get things going. I guess ultimately it's going to have to deal with recruiting. So I don't know what's going to happen this year, but you know, they've got to move forward for the future. They've got to get some better athletes coming in.
Yeah, and to continue a clear theme, you know, Cornell had a 15-point lead, you know, midway through the second half at Hartford. You know, they looked like they were on the verge of a very impressive win at Colgate. Led that game by double digits about 2.5 minutes into the second half there. You know, that game swung the other way fairly quickly after that, though. You know, it's tough to hold on to leads when you've struggled defensively. You don't really have the shooting that you'd like to have. You know, as you said, it's just I think folks knew this was going to be a tough season for Cornell, and you know, it's a transition year, I guess, of sorts. And Brian Earle certainly is one of the league's best, and he'll be able to squeeze out, you know, what he can from the squad. Certainly the home and home with Columbia is a good opportunity for both squads to try to turn the page. Really, they kind of find themselves having the same or similar frustrations with the way games have ended in the non-conference. Time to flip over to the women's side of things, where there's a little bit more agreement on where the teams stand at this point. Princeton is the top squad. I don't think that's necessarily any shocker there. Princeton stands at 12-1. Obviously, the preseason pick. Rob, what news do you have on how what Carly Littlefield's status is?
And according to Coach Berube, it's not a serious problem at all. She more or less, I don't want to say held her out purposely because the kid really wants to play, but she wasn't going to take any chances in a game they won by 40 to expose Carly Littlefield. She's too important to the team, and she'll be fine. They still have another week off, and they travel down to the cluster next weekend. The Carly Littlefield will be in uniform. She'll be at 100%.
Oh, well, there you go. That's good news, George. Rob, what do you think? How do you see Princeton and Penn? Penn is the second team in the power ranking. I don't think anyone would be surprised by that. How do you see Princeton and Penn measuring up to each other going into the conference late?
They've got a really deep team, but it's really important that there are two best players out there. The defensive effort from Princeton has been incredible. I think they're holding teams to about 14 points less than they were last year. Really outstanding defensive effort night in and night out. There's always a different person that kind of rises to the occasion. The difference with Penn, this is the first year in a while where they don't have two all-Ivy front court players at the same time. They really just have Alea Parker, and I'm not sure if she's been injured. Coach McLaughlin's kind of hinted at that she's recovering from something, but I don't know anything definite. Her minutes are down. Other than her blocks, everything is down. Offensively, they've kind of shifted gears, and they've become a more guard-oriented team, especially with Kyla Padilla, who's probably the favorite for the Rookie of the Year. She's one of the top freshman scorers in the country. She's leading the Ivy Leagues. 19.8 points per game. She's hitting 51% from two, 44% from three. And for a team that struggles from the free throw line, she hits almost 80% from the line. She's a tremendous talent. They're going to need her. If Parker's not at full strength, then, Phoebe Sturba is going to have to get some production from three. Padilla is going to need to get production. I think that's a hard that's a hard thing to do against a team that's as good as Princeton. But if there's anyone in the league that's capable, especially at home, it's Penn. But it's a tall order.
Yeah, I mean, I think the scoring prowess that what I think is obviously the Ivy Rookie of the Year has shown for Penn at this point is it throws a new wrinkle into this. I mean, obviously, you know, Penn hasn't gotten that more of a guard oriented attack in years past. Certainly not against Princeton. It's hard to. Until we see it, I think it's hard to say how that's gonna how that's gonna play out. I do think that I don't think the gap between Princeton and Penn is really all that substantial. I didn't think it was last season either. I think that the team split the season series, the Ivy League title game. Could have gone either way. Penn did run out of gas, though. I'm not saying that Princeton wasn't clearly the better team. They were. But I don't think the gap is necessarily that large when you look at the numbers. This is still a high-quality defense that Penn is putting out there. Penn, of course, is 10-1. They've won 6 in a row. Princeton's won 8. 8 in a row now. Yale is as you might expect, a number 3 team in the power ranking. Yale, actually, I mean, are they in the top tier? I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it's necessarily productive to have what teams are in what tier, although I guess we are doing power ranking. But Yale certainly pretty strong so far. They've got the league's top scoring offense sitting at 9-3.
And they beat Courtney Bangard in North Carolina.
They did.
That is an amazing accomplishment.
Handed her first home loss at the helm of the Tar Heels. Certainly did. Camilla Emsbo and Roxy Berriman both rank in the top 5 in the league in scoring. Ellen Margaret Andrews is right up there with them. Camilla Emsbo really a great rim protector, really anchors the team well at both ends of the floor.
I think she missed that North Carolina game, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty remarkable what Yale's been able to accomplish, given the way, first of all, the season ended last year with the collapse in league play, at the end of league play there. But yeah, the North Carolina game, It was a thrill to see that. Yale got out to a great start early, finished strong in the fourth quarter. Camille Emsbo did play in that game. She had foul trouble was the issue there. Yale is certainly a contender. Looking at what they've been able to do, they seem to have more depth, scoring depth than last season. Camille Emsbo obviously has developed and progressed as you would certainly as you would expect from a sophomore. It's exciting to see what they're capable of. Any thoughts on Yale and what their outlook is, Rob?
The concern I had last year with Yale was they could put up points, but they were very inefficient. This year, the numbers have gone up. I think a large testament to that is Camilla Emsbo's maturity and growth, but I also think Ellen Margaret Andrews has been a tremendous asset this year. She team missed all but, I think she got injured 5 games into the season last year, missed most of the year. She's come back this year and you know, I think she's at almost 16 points a game. She had a rough night against Mercer a day or two ago, but generally she's been in some ways their most important player. She hits well from two. She can hit well from three, again, from the free throw line. Really, really impressive. I guess my biggest concern with Yale, and I think they're on a mission. I think they were really, really upset with how things played last year. And you can see, you know, things were starting in a similar vein the first few games, but then they're really been locked in since they went out and played UCLA, out west. It's a much more focused team. Maybe they need to make sure that they play 40 minutes. The last two games, they've had some lighter competition after the UNC game, and they've struggled to come out victorious. But I guess the biggest concern I have is Ensbo's, you know, she's shown a tendency to still get into a little bit of foul trouble against better teams with a strong front court. So when you start seeing them play against teams like Penn and Princeton, you know, that's something to keep your eye on. But again, I think this team has certainly moved into the upper echelon.
Yeah, there does seem to be a bit of separation between the three and the four, in my own estimation, and also in our writer's estimation, given the way the points in our power ranking played out. The fourth team, though, is Harvard. That certainly wasn't unanimous. But Harvard did get enough points to place fourth in the power ranking. Obviously, it's a different team without Katie Benson. The scoring offense for Harvard is down. They're now seventh in the conference, which you know, we're not really accustomed to that. Harvard's been relying certainly on its defense more this season, but you know, the debut of Lola Mullaney has been a very cool thing to see. Easily leads the team in scoring, 15 points per game. What have you heard, Rob, about the latest on Jaden Bush?
So really, there's no timetable for her return. She's missed the whole season. Don't know the specifics of her injury, but there's really no timetable for her to come back, and that's been a big hit. Harvard is a team that is one of the biggest three-point shooting teams in the country, but they've usually been able to balance that out with two all-Ivy front court players. Now, they lost Raster Skinner. Of course, they lost Katie Benson, who is going to do a grad transfer year at UT Austin next year. So they lost a tremendous amount of three-point production, and they now only have Jeannie Baim in the front court. And she's doing really well. She almost has a double-double. I think she's at 9.8 points and 9.9 rebounds a game. But it's really tough. They've got a four-guard offense, and they're doing, I think one of the broadcasts said that they're learning a new offensive system. I think it's modeled on the team at the University of the Sciences. It's a motion offense. And the team is still kind of like looking to kind of feel more comfortable in that. The 3 points, they still shoot a lot of them, but the production numbers have gone down. They were at about 33% last year. They're about 30% this year. And as you alluded to or mentioned, you know, they've won these games mostly on the defensive side. They've done a really nice job on the defensive end. They're going to have to continue that going forward. Harvard's certainly been in the top three for a number of years, but this could be the year that there's a little bit of a shift in the conference power dynamic.
Yeah, certainly Baim is a very strong scorer and rebounder, and you know, she's going to be crucial there in the front court. But I think something that does bode well for Harvard is it's, you know, the defense has been there to rely on, particularly on the perimeter. And that's important come Ivy play, certainly. You know, going up against teams that like to shoot the three, in the Ivy League. Not so much Cornell, maybe.
right.
But, certainly some others. Columbia actually is the next team in the power ranking. I say actually because they were pretty even with Cornell, but finished a point ahead. But yes, Columbia sitting at 8-4. It's been a pretty impressive start for Columbia, especially given their record last season. You know, it's been, I don't know, it, when you look at it, you've got it's still a very young team. You know, they were a young team last season. They're a young team this season. I think the defense is maybe was the liability at times last season, has looked looked stronger. I think that you know, obviously the emergence of Abby Sue as a first year has been pretty cool to see. Certainly an Ivy Rookie of the Year candidate there. You know, Sienna Durr has been a major contributor, as you would expect. You know, it's a team that has a lot of different weapons. You know, Michaela Markham is a very strong, reliable ball distributor. What do you see, Rob, as what does Columbia have to do to break into the top four? Let's ask it that way. What's keeping them from a top four finish, or what do they have to do to get there?
So I think they have to keep up the defensive effort. I think that's the key. They certainly have offensive weapons. They're improving from three. If they can get Madison Hardy and Riley Casey back, those are two more outside shooters. But I think the key is the defensive end. I think right now they're 21st in the country in three-point defense, about 25.2% a night. Offensive rebounding, they're at 36%. A tremendous improvement. I think if they can carry that through, you know, the Ivy League is a lot, it's the eighth best conference. You know, there's a big difference going, you know, some teams like Princeton have an exceptionally hard non-conference schedule. Penn, not really a hard non-conference schedule, relatively not as hard. Columbia, somewhere in the middle. So they've challenged themselves, which is good.
And moving on to Cornell. You know, it's what you would expect. It's a team that you know, under Dana Smith, that crashes the boards, plays strong defense, takes high percentage shots, not a lot of threes. You know, Laura Bagwell Katalinich has had another All Ivy first team caliber start. Through 11 games, Samantha Widman has contributed scoring and rebounding as well. You know, it's the formula for Cornell. It's a pretty distinct one, but it seems to work. They've, you know, when you look at what they've been able to do so far, you look at their schedule. You know, they're. It's been pretty good. They're sitting there, 6-5. You know, they very nearly were able to come out on top against a strong Binghamton team at Newman Arena last month. Came back strong in Morgantown at West Virginia on New Year's Eve. A game they could have easily won after finding themselves down early, pretty hard start to that one, but they were able to climb their way out of it. I don't know, can Cornell make it back again? Rob, what do you think?
I mean, they have an incredible defense. I mean, it's really amazing to watch them play. I think they're top 10 in the offensive rebounding and top 25 on the defensive side, even without their three-point shooting. And it has improved this year. but they still stay in games. The biggest problem is turnovers. They're 320th in the country in turnover rate. They would have beaten Colgate. They would have beaten West Virginia. I'm confident in saying that if they had cut down the turnovers. That's been a problem. About 3 years ago, they had a senior-laden team. They were very good at holding on to the ball. Since those five starting seniors graduated, the last three seasons, they've had a lot of trouble holding on to the ball. If they can find a way to do that, then I think they can certainly, you know, get into the top four.
Yeah, they did. They had 20 turnovers in Morgantown, and that was probably the biggest hurdle that they couldn't quite overcome in that one. But you know, it's the way their games go, though, the defensive battles that they are. I don't know. I just like that style because you don't see it as much anymore.
Yeah.
So it is refreshing to watch them play. And they are able to offset their turnovers with the defensive intensity with which they play. So, yeah, I mean, I don't see it. It's very easy to envision them making the Ivy League tournament again. I think, you know, they're in my top four at the moment. But it's a fluid middle of the league right now, which is, you know, it's exciting. That's what you want as a fan, I guess, is that parity that's there. Moving on, we've got Dartmouth in the seventh slot. You know, there's some roster turnover there that I think has been maybe a bit of a challenge to overcome for the Big Green sitting there. I don't know. Where do you see Dartmouth at this point, Rob? Coming off of three straight losses, they're sitting there at 6-7. They've had much more success at home than away, certainly. But where do the Big Green stand at this point?
I would say, I have them seventh. They play hard. You know, there's no doubt. They never give up. They work really hard. I just don't think they have the depth or the talent. You know, when you're talking about the top six teams in the league, those are some pretty talented teams, both on the offensive and or defensive side. And Dartmouth just doesn't have. They don't score a lot of points. The defense is kind of middle of the road nationally. They compete well in the first, you know, there's usually for a half, sometimes three quarters, but they just run out of gas against stronger teams. And I think would it shock me if they pulled off an upset here and there during the conference play? No. But I realistically, I don't expect them to be a factor.
Yeah, I mean, Annie McKenna has been a very impressive ball distributor. Of course, you know, this is a team that's whose roster has changed significantly from last season when Cy Lippold was there, and of course Ice Quinones. Paul Leonard is still doing a good job for them in the paint. But yeah, I mean, the offensive firepower just doesn't seem to be there. That's the biggest thing that stands out to me. It's kind of hard to overcome that. Size differential has been a challenge for Dartmouth. They play hard, which is kind of a weird thing to say. You would expect all teams to play hard, and I think they do, but the Big Green do play very very intense defense, which I think definitely helps, but the offensive firepower isn't there. It's just hard to make up for that. So So that's where the teams stand at this point on the men's and women's side. Let's step into a time machine and go back all the way back into the 2010s. Don't have to calibrate it too much. It really a transformative decade for Ivy League basketball when you look at how the decade started. You know, in the 2000s, not a lot of NCAA tournament success to speak of. You had the Penn Princeton duopoly on the men's side was still was by 2010 it was already crumbling or had crumbled, but really we got a decade of parity, a decade where you start out with a Sweet 16 run for Cornell. On the men's side, the profile has grown immensely. On the women's side as well, we did get a two-bid Ivy on the women's side in 2017. It's really extraordinary when you think about how the women's side has progressed and gotten more attention as well. Now we have an Ivy League tournament. The Ivy League as we know it is just a different animal now. Any thoughts, George, as to what the decade that was meant to Ivy Hoops?
Clearly, the recruiting standards have been lifted considerably, and you got to credit Tommy Amaker and the way he turned things around at Harvard. That development. Everybody has had to recruit better, or they're just going to fall by the wayside. And I think that's shown that a lot of programs have. Yale's continued to recruit well. Penn continues to recruit well and can compete. Princeton has had a lot of success in this decade. Right now, it seems to me they're on the decline somewhat. But Mike Martin's done a tremendous job at Brown. So, the league as a whole has gotten a lot better and a lot deeper in terms of talent and personnel. Harvard has just been phenomenal in the last 10 years. I think they've won or shared the title, so that's an amazing record.
Yeah, it certainly is. So let's dive into our players of the decade. There's a lot of talent to choose from, that's for sure. So let's get into it. And I should correct myself. 2016 was the season for the two-bit Ivy on the women's side, not 2017. Starting with the top of the list, the player that got the most points, I don't think is any surprise, Bella Allery. I think certainly a worthy player of the decade, as it were, given what she can do inside and outside and what her accomplishments have been as a two-time reigning Ivy League Player of the Year. George, what can you say about Bella Allery and what she's meant to Princeton and to Ivy League basketball?
I think she's meant everything to Princeton and an awful lot to Ivy League basketball. She's developed actually an international reputation in the last year. She's played in a lot of international events and has acquitted herself very well. She's on pace to be career leading in scoring, rebounding, and already she's got the school record in block shots.
And coming in just behind Bella Allery in the voting was another Princeton great, Naveen Rashid, a unanimous Ivy League Player of the Year twice, finished fourth in program history in scoring, really was the key to Princeton kind of taking over in the Courtney Banghart era early in the decade. Jerry Price over at the Tiger blog wrote up a piece recently about the best athletes of the decade, best women's athletes, and said that kind of compared Bella Allery and Naveen Rashid, and said that Bella Allery is dominant. If she can be described as dominant, Naveen Rashid was best described as ferocious, and talked about the fact that she was really the cornerstone of the dynasty that emerged, and it was kind of a turning point for the program, I suppose, her leadership and performance earlier in the decade. Any memories of Naveen Rashid in her play, George?
She was one of the most active kids on the floor at all times. She was tireless. She was lightning fast. She was a lot of fun to watch play because she was so quick and so skillful. She was a fun player to watch.
Yeah, she certainly was. Next on the list, another standout from earlier in the decade, Alyssa Barron. I happened to be in the same graduating class as Alyssa, and she was as much of a cornerstone for Penn's program at the time as Rashid was for Princeton. Certainly it was pretty unthinkable when I first came to campus at the start of the decade as a student in 2010 that Penn was going to be winning Ivy League championships. By the time we graduated in 2014, that was a reality. And really that was due to the leadership of Alyssa Barron and what she was able to do at both ends of the floor. Certainly as a ball distributor, as a scorer, she was a unanimous first team All Ivy selection as a junior, as a senior, Ivy League Player of the Year, senior year. Yeah, I mean she really did. I want to say a little bit of everything, but she kind of did a lot of everything. Started all 116 games. She really was the cornerstone, leading to, helping make it a duopoly rather than the Princeton monopoly it looked like it was going to become earlier in the decade. Also on the list, Michelle McQuetty. Another Penn legend, she kind of picked it up later in the decade chronologically, obviously. As you said, Rob, Penn folks are used to having a dynamic front court, multiple players excelling in the front court, and certainly Betty is part of that equation, maybe the biggest part of the equation in recent times for Penn. Helped Penn win a Big Five championship her senior year. Did a lot of everything well. Any remembrances, I guess, of what she meant to the program, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, she was excellent.
excellent. She you know, really, really ferocious down low. But what really impressed me was, and it's funny because I guess I would link her with Sydney Stepanovich. So, you know, the two of them are like, you know, right together for me. But what I really liked about Nochetti was she adjusted her game based on what the team needed. So when Alea Parker showed up, she, you know, kind of moved back and reduced her role a little bit. And this was after she was the player of the year before. Real team-oriented player, super talented, a winner, a leader, but, you know, was always putting the team first. You can't beat that.
No. I mean, certainly, you know, team captain, as you might expect, certainly a selfless leader, as you said, tweaking her game and what she offered when Alea Parker came aboard. Also on the list, the aforementioned Sydney Stepanovich. They go together, and they go together on the list too. You know, two-time team captain, the 2016 Ivy League Player of the Year, all-time career block shots leader in Ivy League history, on the women or the men. 317 career blocks, really anchored an awesome Penn defense. Anything to add to that, Rob?
I think she was, if I'm not mistaken, she was player of the year and defensive player of the year.
That's right, yes.
Which is the first in Ivy competition. So, you know, again, a tremendous, tremendous athlete. I think she, if I'm not mistaken, she may have struggled a little bit with injuries her senior year, but, you know, that was certainly a great offensive and defensive players in league history.
Yeah. Also, another entry on the list, Nia Marshall of Cornell, the two-time first-team All-Ivy selection, Cornell's all-time scoring leader. I think she was recently recognized by the Cornell Sun, Daily Sun, as one of the all-time players of the decade across Cornell athletics. Certainly a standout. Really, a lot of talent on teams that weren't Penn and Princeton, even in a decade that was dominated by them. Blake Dietrich, no surprise, a Princeton legend, of course, a great ball distributor, certainly, what she was able to do for Princeton, unanimous Ivy League Player of the Year as a senior. Anything that stands out to you, George, about Blake Dietrich and her time at Princeton?
What stands out to me was the fact that she was a winner. She made her team better than the sum of its parts. If you follow my drift there, there have been a lot of great players who have done that, and Blake Dietrich was one of them. She did a lot of things well. She didn't do, wouldn't say she was a phenomenal shooter, a phenomenal ball handler, a phenomenal defender, but she did everything with a sense of style and timing and made her team better. And of course, had some time in the WNBA, which certainly tells you something about her ability and her character. I'm going to have to apologize at this point, but I have an engagement and I'm going to be late now. We've gone on for some time. I didn't know we'd be going this long, and I certainly apologize. But I hope to be together with you guys in the future as we go forward in the season, and thanks for giving me a chance to talk to you today.
Oh, sure, George. Yeah, we had a lot to talk about, I guess. We hadn't done it in a while,
so. We still do.
We still will going forward, yeah. Well, thanks so much for taking time out to join us.
Oh, my pleasure.
George Clark.
I'll be in touch with you next week after the Penn-Princeton game.
Absolutely. George Clark, Ivy League writer extraordinaire. Take care, George. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, it's just you and me, Rolf.
Okay.
Up next on the list, Christine Clark of Harvard. Finished fourth in Harvard history in points. Three-time All-League first-teamer. That's pretty rare. She was certainly one of the standout players from earlier in the decade. Really was great at getting to the foul line and anchoring a backcourt for Harvard that was a strong one and certainly one to remember. Also on the list, Camille Zimmerman, much more recent talent, obviously, for Columbia, seemed to win all Met everything every year.
Yeah.
for the Lions, all-time leading scorer and rebounder in team history. I think that pretty much says it all right there. And Sarah Halajian of Yale also rounding out the list. Two-time All-Ivy first teamer in the middle of the decade. Great ball distributor for the Bulldogs. Also receiving votes, if I can read my list correctly here. Katie Benzin of Harvard, certainly a great talent, a shooting talent that unfortunately is transferred away. Shayna Mehta of Brown, Lauren Edwards of Princeton, a three-time All-Ivy first teamer, if I remember correctly, from earlier in the decade. And also Addie Messier, also of Princeton, and also no longer in the Ivy universe, now an associate head coach at Lehigh. But a lot of great talent there. On the men's side, what can you say? We had a little bit more of differentiation at the top of the league, receiving the most votes. Or points, I should say, in our scoring system was Zach Rosen of Penn. I think you could have gone any number of ways there. Certainly, there were the three players that were clearly the top tier, the upper echelon, were Zach Rosen, Wesley Saunders, and Justin Sears. Those were the three in that order. I don't know. I mean, when you look at the list, it's pretty gobsmacking how much talent there has been in the conference this decade. I know we keep saying it, but it's certainly true. Zach Rosen, what comes to mind, Rob? Any remembrances of what he meant to Penn basketball? I mean, for me, it was just a lot of hero ball and Zach Rosen saving the day over and over and over again. I mean,
absolutely. That's exactly it. I mean, it was a real, in general, a pretty low point in the program history, or maybe the start of the low point of the program history. But he was much, much watched basketball every night. He could shoot from anywhere. He could take over a game.
Looking up his some of the statistics on SportReference.com, he had I forget what it was, but it was a really high number of win shares credited to him, and you didn't really need to look that up to know that, but it goes to show what he meant to Penn and an offense that was really just designed around him. And defensively, he was a very strong player too. Wesley Saunders, what can you say? I mean, he was probably the most clutch
player of the decade, or certainly among them. I don't know. You don't have too many three-time All-Ivy first-teamers.
Yeah.
Two-time Lou Henson All-American. How many players can say they went to the NCAA tournament all 4 years? I would say, chiefly because of what he brought to the table. Certainly his sophomore through senior seasons, maybe not so much the rookie season. Justin Sears, two-time player of the year, rim protector, Ian Hummer, 2013 Ivy League player of the year, did so much well as a big man. Spencer Weiss, great player. Not too many guards could post up like him. Quarterback of a team that went 16-0, that kind of speaks for itself. Who else do we have here? AJ Broder, generational as far as what he's meant at both ends, just remarkably consistent at both ends of the floor. And he was the biggest factor in Penn getting to an Ivy League championship for the first time in 11 years. Bryce Aiken, arguably the most electrifying player of the decade. Can shoot from anywhere. An underrated defender. I don't know. What can you say? The 44-point game against Columbia last year stands out. Stand out, really, at both ends of the floor for Cornell. Keith Wright, rounding out the list. 2011 Player of the Year was also a huge factor anchoring the paint in the first Harvard team 2012 to make the NCAA tournament era. That's a lot of great talent there. I would have liked to have seen John McGonigal and Mauta Loh on that list. I have to rep for first while host Peter Andrews in singing the praises of Mauta Loh, but he's one of the most electrifying talents out there. John McGonigal was a great leader, great ball distributor, great defender on a couple of really solid, strong Brown teams his junior and senior years under Mike Martin. Any other names come to mind on the men's side?
I guess there were guys like Sean Miller at Cornell, who was also a super talent.
And I didn't say Mia Oney. I skipped over.
Of course.
Mia Oney.
Drafted, yes.
Yes, only... he was in the top five, actually. Yeah, so I don't want to... Didn't mean to skip him over, obviously. So that's the lists in a nutshell. And that's where Ivy League stands at this point. Any predictions for the game tomorrow night?
I'm gonna go with Penn tomorrow. I think the offense is just too much, so I think they're gonna I think they'll do fine. I think they'll deal with their nerves at the beginning of especially the freshmen, but I think the offense is too good and Princeton's defense is still a work in progress. How about you?
I do like Penn, and maybe a little lower scoring of the game than Penn might want. I just think Penn's too much on the perimeter. Maybe inside, as George alluded to earlier, perhaps Richmond and Riguzo and AJ Broder offset cancel each other out a bit. But yeah, on the perimeter, Penn just, you know, has too much talent, I think. Really, this is Penn's game to lose, and I'm not going to pick against them at the Palestra. You know, I don't think Princeton pulls this one out and gets a third straight in the rivalry. But yeah, so Rob Brown, thank you so much for spending so much time imparting all your knowledge. Went over an awful lot the double stuffed episode, so I appreciate you. Appreciate you taking time out to go over an entire decade and then some of analysis. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Mike.